And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with the executive director of Food and Water Watch. She's Winona Howder. She says the U.S. is in a food crisis because of corporate agribusiness driving independent farmers out of production. She's written Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. And Winona Howder joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to you.
I'm so pleased to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So, Winona, currently how many corporations are controlling our entire food industry? And I'm interested to know if we're also speaking about organic foods.
Well, yes. If we're talking about the foods that you buy in the grocery store, we have 20 food processing companies that control 60% of all of the brands. So it looks like there's all of this diversity, all of this choice, but in reality, we have just this handful of companies that have really all of this power over what Americans are eating. And the top five brands are PepsiCo, that has dozens of brands of mostly salty junk food, Nestle, Kraft, the giant meat company Tyson, and the giant Brazilian meat company JBS that owns U.S. brands like Swift. And then we have four grocery chains that control overall 50% of grocery sales, but in most suburban and rural areas, they control 70 to 90% of grocery sales. And of course, those four are Tyson, the Kroger brands, Target, and Costco. And today, one out of three grocery dollars is spent at Walmart. And the Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans. And I think that's kind of a metaphor, right, for what's wrong with our food system today. And unfortunately, we see the same large food processing companies controlling a lot of the organic brands. So we have companies like General Mills that owns Muir, Glen Organic and Cascadian Farms and a couple of others. We have Kellogg's that owns Morningstar, Cashew, and Bare Naked and some others. We have Kraft that owns Boca and Back to Nature and Green and Blacks. ConAgra owns Light Life and Alexa. And, you know, and I could go on. The 14 largest food processing companies also own organic brands.
But shouldn't the marketplace decide what's on our food store shelves? If people don't buy products, they'll go out of business.
Well, you know, I think what's happened is a number of political decisions have been made really over the last 40 years that have dramatically changed our food system. And in fact, you know, we're supposed to have an economic system that is governed by competition and the market. But really, that's just all rhetoric, because all public policies have been changed to allow massive consolidation. And that's true in every industry, but especially in the food industry. And that really began the consolidation full force in the early 1980s when antitrust laws were pretty much, the definition was narrowed, and the budgets for the agencies, and that's the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, were severely cut. Whole departments were gotten rid of, and there was a decision made that companies could get as large as they want. And that deregulation really, along with some other changes to farm policy that created very cheap commodities, has had a very dramatic effect on our food system. And I would also say our political system, because what happens when companies are allowed to get as big as they want? And we've had those mergers and acquisitions going on really since the 1980s. That trend has continued, where we get a very few number of very large companies that have a lot of money and have been able to have an effect on our laws and our regulations, so that really everything to do about our food system, most of those policy decisions have been influenced by the very large agribusiness and food companies that control our food system. So that's not the market. That's a political decision.
So you actually, I heard you call it legalized system of bribery.
Yes, that's right. We've ended up in our political system with, you know, money really having a voice. And so we have a few very powerful actors in our democracy, a lot of them different corporations, but also a handful of very wealthy individuals who influence elections. And then those elected officials, rather than being accountable to the people who elect them, are accountable to where the money came from. And so, you know, I don't think that we're just fighting for our food system. I actually think that we're fighting for our democracy. And I think it's very hypocritical for a lot of these very large companies to say that this is the market working, when really this is kind of a perversion of the marketplace by allowing just a few companies to control it, and by not having vigorous competition. You know, we just have an illusion of competition.
But don't most average and low-income Americans want food costs to stay low and not pay premiums for organics and fancy varieties?
Well, first of all, I'm going to argue about cheap food. Yes, there is cheap food available. You know, you can get that dollar burger or some ramen noodles. There's not a lot of nutrition there. But if you're actually going into the grocery store and you're purchasing the kinds of foods that keep you healthy, lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, you know, a little bit of meat. Actually, the food budget over the last 10 years has been going up 3% a year overall, and in the last 30 years, the price that a farmer gets for raising livestock, because of the consolidation of the meatpacking industry, it's gone down 30%, but the price of meat like pork and beef has gone up 40%. And overall, a farmer just gets, on average, 16 cents out of every dollar. But if you're looking at something like corn in a box of corn flakes, the farmer gets about 3 cents. And that's because all of that extra money goes to the marketing and the packaging and the grocery industry. So food prices are going up, and I think that one of the reasons we need to reclaim our democracy is that we need people's wages to keep up with food prices so that they can actually afford to buy healthy food.
What's your take on the surge in popularity in stores such as Whole Foods, Fresh Market, Trader Joe's, and such?
Well, you know, I think many people do want organic food, or, you know, what they perceive as more natural food. You know, I think that when you look at those sales compared to conventional grocery stores, they're much lower, but people are going to look for foods that don't have as many chemicals in their diet. I do believe that for someone who cooks and doesn't eat processed food, it is possible to eat a healthier diet, even though I know many people are suffering from the terrible stratification that we have in the U.S. now, where there's such a gap between the, you know, that very small percentage of people who have resources and the growing percentage of people who are poor and who are actually being removed from the middle class. But that if you cook, you are able to purchase foods that are healthier and to make things that will help your family, and, you know, in terms of getting good nutrition. Of course, you need to have some access to money to do this. And today we know that there is a move by a small, I would say radical group of members of the House of Representatives that are trying to take that safety net away from Americans so that they don't have access to food at all for people who are really on the edge.
You're talking about the SNAP program.
Yeah, the SNAP program, that there is a move in the House to almost eliminate, to remove about $40 billion from the SNAP program.
We're speaking with Winona Howder. She's executive director of Food and Water Watch. She owns an organic farm in Northern Virginia. And the name of her book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. Please stay with us.
And we return 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're also joined by Winona Howder. Her book is called Foodopoly. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email. That's radio@WLRN.org. Winona Howder, give us a little bit of a feel of your farm in Northern Virginia. If Bonnie and I were to come up and visit you, what would we see?
Well, you know, first of all, I grew up on this farm in the early 1960s, and my parents didn't have a whole lot of money. They were missionaries, and they ended up with this pretty funky farm 45 miles from D.C. And you'll have to remember that in those days, there was no major superhighway going out into the Virginia countryside. And in fact, D.C. was a pretty sleepy little town without any of the suburbs and the massive traffic that we have today. So getting that farm out in Virginia, you know, it was really the sticks. But today, because of the massive development in this area, there is a tremendous amount of traffic, but there's also a large population base, which is why I'm very fortunate, because I inherited a farm 45 miles from a major city.
With the increase in property values, the taxes must have gone up astronomically, only 45 miles.
Yeah,
from Washington,
well,
D.C.
The taxes have gone up, but we have, in the county that I live in, we have tax relief for people who actually farm. Now, the county that is right over the border from us, Prince William County, has actually allowed all of the massive development and doesn't have any of those benefits for people farming, and so we now have, you know, thousands and thousands of townhouses and shopping centers and all of the congestion that brings. But for somebody who has a farm and wants to do direct sales, that is a real opportunity. So for about the last 15 years, my husband has run the farm as a subscription vegetable program. So, you know, known as community-supported agriculture. Where,
explain that. Explain what that is.
Well, it's when a farmer grows, in his case, whatever grows in Virginia. So, you know, in the spring, that's greens and things like broccoli and cabbage and kale, and then you move into summer vegetables, you know, eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, squash, and then into the fall into more squash and going back to greens and some of those spring-type vegetables. So it's whatever is ripe, and it is sold as kind of a package. So somebody joins the farm and they get to select whatever is ripe that week, like a bag of vegetables, and they pay up front for it. And so in the case of my husband, he's, you know, been doing this for for a decade and a half, and so he has a lot of customers who are happy to have that delivered. Some parts of the country, people actually visit the farm, but most of my husband's customers get their vegetables through drop-off points around the city, because we have so much traffic today that people can't make it out to the farm on a work day.
Does that include restaurants?
No, it does not include restaurants. I mean, some people deliver to restaurants, but my husband doesn't need to. So, you know, that works if you have a large population base and you don't have too many farmers doing it. It is not really, it's great in the places that it works and for the people that it works for on both sides, the farmer and the consumer. Many farmers, in fact, two-thirds of farms are located nowhere near a population base, so they can't very well be doing direct sales. And even places like New York City that has, you know, a large number of farmers markets, you almost have to die somebody has to die to get a spot in the farmer's market, if you know what I mean. Someone has to leave and be replaced because it's so competitive to have a spot at the farmer's market. So part of the point of my book, Foodopoly, is these programs, these local food programs, are great for the education and for the people who can partake in them, but we really need to fix our larger food system so that everybody can enjoy having access to fresh, local, delicious food, and so that all farmers can make a living. And so I think that, you know, we should vote with our fork, but then we need to vote with our vote, and then we need to hold the people accountable that we vote for, which I think is one of the things that we're not doing a very good job of in this country.
So what do you suggest we as individuals do to remedy the situation?
Well, I do think it's important to feed yourself and to feed your family as healthily as possible. And, you know, if you have access to local fruits and vegetables or meats, that's great. You should partake of it. And also all of the other social and educational programs that the local food movement offers. But I think the long-term changes really need to be political, and that means that we really need to get people involved in the political system again. And I really wrote Foodopoly as a call to action, because we almost never have any conversation about how the consolidation of industry in our society is affecting both our food system or a lot of other aspects of our society. You know, we really need a functional and fair market. And one of the things that we need is an investigation by those research agencies associated with Congress into the state of competition in our agricultural markets. And, you know, if we're going to make that happen, we need people to start demanding it. And I think that we need people to really get involved in their communities and in their states again in what's going on politically, because today people feel like, well, there's nothing that we can really do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all kind of fixed. And I think that the economic interests that benefit from people not getting involved like it to stay that way. You know, there's a lot of pressure for people to be apathetic, and we really need to get people involved again in politics.
Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You had another question, Bonnie?
Yes, I had a question. When you talked about the poultry industry, you said that only two companies sell one half of the 1 billion chickens consumed in the U.S. each year, and that they're vertically integrated. Could you talk about that and tell us about the dangers for consumers and the contract growers?
Yes, I would love to be able to do that, because I think that we are not hearing enough honest discussion about what's going on in the poultry industry. Vertical integration means that there's one company that controls a food product all the way from its start, either as a, in the case of poultry, the genetics of the chick, all the way to the grocery store brand. So today we have just a few companies that actually control poultry, and it does start, it really does start at the genetics. And the way that this works is that a company, let's use the largest poultry company in the country, which is Tyson Foods. Tyson owns the genetics. They own the chicks. They provide the chick to the contract grower. Contracts with a company like Tyson are pretty non-negotiable, and people don't have a long-term contract. Their contracts are mostly from flock to flock, so they never know when they're going to get that next flock of birds. The poultry company comes and picks up the birds after about 40 days. That's the full age of a broiler, or the kind of chicken that you you buy in the grocery store and cook at home. The company like Tyson contracts with what they call people who are chicken catchers, who go into these big facilities that I'm going to describe in a minute. But they go in, and after the chicken is about 40 days old, they catch them by their legs and put them in these cages in the back of Tyson's giant trucks, and then they're taken to a Tyson slaughter facility. Eventually, after the meat is packaged, it goes to the grocery store under the Tyson brand. Now, one of the things that the poultry industry has done is, beginning with the Clinton administration and through every administration since then, they have lobbied to reduce the meat inspection, so that today they lobbied the Obama administration to allow 175 birds per minute to be slaughtered. Mm. That's per minute. And obviously, you can have no real inspection program when meat is moving that quickly down the slaughter line. So the companies use chemical baths, sometimes two, because the fecal matter does get splattered on the meat. And it they use trisodium phosphate and then chlorine baths. Now, for those contract growers, a lot of them refer to themselves as serfs. Average contract growers make from between $12,000 to $15,000 a year. And the way that they get into the business is, well, first of all, they're usually located in the southeastern United States. These are often people who are trying to save the family farm. They're made a lot of promises by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that often underwrites the loans for these huge chicken facilities. They're like warehouses where, you know, as many as 300,000 birds are squished in together with not even a square foot to be able to move around in. So obviously they're wallowing around in their own waste. They've traditionally been fed a feed. Oh, I forgot to mention the poultry company, like Tyson, also owns the feed, and the contract growers don't get to weigh it when the feed is delivered to their large facility. They've taken on a lot of debt when they purchase one of these big facilities, and like I said, USDA often underwrites the loan.
You're talking about a farm subsidy?
This is not a subsidy. This is a loan where a farmer puts their farm up for collateral.
I see.
And the USDA, if it defaults, the bank gets the farm, but the USDA kind of underwrites the loan so that the bank doesn't have to eat it if the farm isn't worth what the bank actually paid for the facility. Now, this means that these contract growers are afraid to complain to the chicken company. They're very docile because they don't know when they're getting their next flock. And in fact, the way that they're paid is based on how the feed ends up becoming meat. So there's an equation of the poundage of meat divided by the amount of feed.
Winona Howder, let me take a call or two. First up, we have Ken in Weston. Hi there.
Hi, Winona. This is a great topic, and thank you for WLRN to cover it. I've been on the line waiting for a while, and you've just covered so many fantastic sides, but I'm going to make one comment and then ask a question. And the comment is, earlier you were asked, well, of course, aren't we all trying to get cheap food? This could. And I almost ran off the road. Of course, fast food and everything gives, those that are more economically deprived a source of really cheap, crappy food. And of course, it encourages all of the and promotes all of the illnesses that we all know, whether it's diabetes or overweight or whatever. So that just is part of the overall system. And you're addressing that in this complicated system. I guess my question would be, you've covered so many different aspects. Could you talk about the farm bill and how, we have 435 members of the House, congressional districts. How many are directly affected by subsidies to the farm bill? Because it just seems like there's a catch there somewhere that's just not right.
Well, first of all, the people on the ag committees are who have traditionally made the decisions about a farm bill being passed. This year, in fact, for the last 3 years, we've been unable to get a farm bill passed because a lot of political reasons. I think the farm bill is tied up in the political factionalism in Congress, and the fact that it's passed has less to do with what's in the farm bill than with the composition of Congress and the fact that we have a handful of members of Congress who probably aren't reflective of most Americans' values. But in terms of the subsidy issue, we always hear so much about subsidies. And, it's kind of a red herring. We could get rid of all subsidies tomorrow and we'd still have a dysfunctional food system. Now, there are, most members of Congress who have anything to do with passing, anything to do with agriculture, are getting huge amounts of money from agribusiness, lobbying and campaign contributions. So they do have an enormous amount of influence on the farm bill. And I think that there are going to need to be a lot of long-term changes in the farm bill if we're going to have a better food policy that go beyond getting rid of the subsidies. And in fact, there's no doubt that if we actually pass one of these versions of the bill and it goes and they go to conference committee, that those payments that everybody is talking about will probably be eliminated. There'll be some kind of insurance program for some farmers. But I can guarantee you we'll still have a dysfunctional food system.
Okay, Ken, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Thank you.
We need to move along to some callers, Winona.
Okay.
This is Michael in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm Michael Mathis. I love hearing what you have to say, Winona, and I agree with you 100% on almost everything. But one thought I have, we live here in South Florida as a unique solution, would be to develop our sort of our own local food system. We can grow food here all year round. And if we could set up an example of a local food system that could actually support a local economy, like you say, it would sort of put the wealth back into the middle class who'd be running that smaller localized industry.
You know, I couldn't agree more that it makes sense for people in Florida, in fact, all of the warm weather states, to be growing their own food. In fact, almost everywhere in this nation, we could be growing a large percentage of the food that's eaten. I learned in writing Foodopoly that even Montana was self-sufficient up into the 1950s when the grocery industry moved in. Now, we probably have a deeper desire for more fruits and vegetables that are fresh today. But this could really help the local economy. And I think the problem is getting around the issue that there's no fair market and how to distribute these vegetables and fruits and other foods and how to actually, for farmers to be assured of a market and a place to sell these fruits and vegetables. Now, we did see this a pilot program work in a place, Kansas City, Missouri, and the surrounding area, actually has a very small grocery chain that put one of their warehouses at the disposal of a farmers co-op that was coming together. And they sell the fruits and vegetables through their grocery store. And it's a kind of a long, drawn-out process that's been fraught with a lot of problems, but it is providing a market for farmers and a fair price for them and then good food for consumers. But most of the grocery industry is only interested in low price. And in fact, people have been trained that you go to where the price is lowest. And that's not always the best, highest quality or what we should be looking at. And this whole Walmartization of our food system and just about everything else as well is part of, you know, the problem where even the largest farms in California aren't able to be productive and stay in business unless they become consolidated. You know, we're talking 10,000 plus acres, and they have to have a relationship with a shipper packer to be able to do business with these big grocery chains. So, I think it's a great idea, and I think we should do what we can to start these local initiatives, but I do believe that we're going to have to change some of these rules around consolidation and making our market fairer. And in fact, that's one of the things that we at Food and Water Watch advocate in the Farm Bill. We need a competition title that actually straightens out some of the rules that relate to why the market is so unfair and the growers of our food can't get a fair price. Even though the price for consumers is going up, but, you know, it's kind of grabbed by these middlemen.
Do you think that we have enough information? I want to get back to Food and Water Watch after a time, but do you think we have enough information about genetically engineered foods?
No, I think we need labeling. I think it pretty much sums up the problem when you know how much money the major food processing and biotech companies are spending to keep the ballot initiatives that require labeling of genetically engineered food from becoming law. They were able to stop an initiative from passing in California with $50 million, but it lost only by a couple of points. And so people in Washington state got signatures, and there's a major battle going on there that the next week or so before the election over the labeling of genetically engineered food. And, you know, we believe everybody has a right to know how their food is produced and what's in their food, and there shouldn't be this secrecy. And so we support labeling of genetically engineered food.
And what would the label show?
Label would show if the food had or vegetable was genetically engineered. If you know, if you're talking about a vegetable, whether the actual food item that you're buying, or if we're talking about a processed food, whether it has genetically engineered ingredients. And most processed food, these are, you know, junk foods that have a lot of corn and soy in them, are genetically engineered. And, you know, processed food isn't good for you anyway. And the processed food industry sure doesn't want people to know that a lot of these ingredients are genetically engineered. In fact, every candy bar that your child eats today, unless it's organic, has genetically engineered sugar in it, for instance.
What about world hunger, third world countries that perhaps could depend on genetically modified foods to be delivered there and be cheap?
Well, you know, I think it's actually the opposite. People in the developing world, in fact, peasant farmers, have been doing a pretty good job of feeding themselves. But there are a number of industries, the processed food industry, that wants peasants to be moved into the dollar economy and eating westernized processed foods, not the traditional foods that that they have been growing and feeding themselves with. And the biotech industry wants to sell seeds. They don't want peasant farmers saving seeds, and they want them to buy all of those chemical inputs that are co-branded with the genetically engineered seeds. So I think it is one of the most ruthless and disgusting advertising campaigns, propaganda campaigns, that the biotech industry is laying out there, that this is about feeding people. This is about charging people for seeds and inputs, not about feeding people.
But what about the thousands and thousands of children that die every day of malnutrition?
That has nothing to do with feeding them genetically engineered food. People die from hunger today because of the lack of distribution for food. When people are going hungry, in fact, 2008 is a good example when about a billion people went hungry. That was because of the speculation over commodities, over the foods that people need to survive. The U.S. is the price setter for the entire world for commodity crops. When crops are being speculated on here, it means that the price goes way up in the developing world, and that causes hunger. So it's actually all about deregulation, not the availability of food. Food is available, people just don't have the money to buy it. So pushing more poor people into a dollar economy where there aren't jobs to actually give them a livable wage is the opposite of what we need to do to feed people. If we really wanted to feed people, the UN has come out recently with a number of proposals, and it was not that we needed genetically engineered seeds. This is the UN Environment Program, and they said that there should be tools for farmers, and that actually hybridization was of the crops that they normally grow was really the way that yields could be increased, and that farmers could be helped by having the proper tools. So, you know, I think we have to look at all these arguments that get trotted out that aren't really about feeding people. They're really about making money for a few economic players in the food system.
We're speaking with Winona Howder. She's executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she owns an organic farm in Northern Virginia. It's a community-supported agriculture project. We're going to take another short break. The name of her book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. One more short break, and we'll return.
And we're back with Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Winona Howder. We're talking about her book, Foodopoly. Tell me, Winona Howder, the story of high fructose corn syrup and how that the usage of that has become so widespread.
Well, this really began back in the 1970s when soda companies were actually using sugar. And rather than continuing to use sugar, there was a recognition that by some of the companies involved in producing corn that they could make a lot of money by getting the soda industry to use high fructose corn syrup. And so they worked to actually learn the technology, and then they twisted the arms of the soda industry and got them to start using this high fructose corn syrup, which there's a lot of evidence actually makes people gain weight faster than conventional sugar. And the brains behind this was Archer Daniels Midland, and I think it's it really exemplifies the kind of power that this kind of company can have on our food system. And they were able to market this high fructose corn syrup because they were a very large company, and they sold it to the industry as they told them that it inhibits microbial spoilage, it doesn't crystallize, it gives bakery goods a soft texture, and that it withstands temperature fluctuations. And so they were very successful. And by 1984, when the price of sugar increased, Archer Daniels Midland persuaded PepsiCo and Coke to announce that they were switching to this high fructose corn syrup. And the reason that sugar was going up was because ADM had worked with the Florida sugar interest to lobby the Reagan administration for a sugar tariff that's actually remained in place ever since then. Mm. So, that's kind of the story. We can almost look at any food that is being lobbied for by these corporate interests, and there's usually a backstory like this.
Let's take another call or two. This is Orlando in Miami Beach. He's been on a long time. Thanks for your patience. And I'm a little short on time, Orlando.
Oh, how are you? Good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is an extremely interesting conversation. I am very impressed with this, and I'm going to read this book, Foodopoly, for sure. I guess the name Foodopoly, first of all, I'd like to ask you, how did you come up with that name? Does that have anything to do with politics?
Well, I came up with the name because the food industry, most of the companies are monopolies, and so Foodopoly was a play on the monopoly concept.
Okay, thank you. We have been talking about this from a political standpoint. I'm very interested in trying to help you support this effort to bring decision making process back to the people.
How about contact info, Winona Howder?
It's foodandwaterwatch.org, and we have many ways that people can get involved with our campaign work. We have an office in Fort Lauderdale and are very active in Florida.
And you also have foodopoly.org, right?
Yes, foodopoly.org is the other website for the book.
Perfect. That's a lot easier. Let me ask you, if I may, one question. With the enactment of the Food Quality Protection Act in 1996, Congress presented EPA with this enormous challenge of implementing the most comprehensive and historic overhaul of the nation's pesticide and food safety laws in decades. Back then, how can we today access maybe a political action committee or something to implement some kind of effect from Congress so that we can get something done?
Well, I think that, you know, to affect what a member of Congress does, you have to be a constituent, you know, unless you have a lot of money and are going to become a major contributor. So that's why it takes organizing in your community, in your congressional district, to begin to be able to influence these people. And I think it's important to start locally because we need people to run for office. We need to have more vigilance directed at state legislatures, since some of them have been so gerrymandered, and every 10 years the state legislature draws the districts up of a state, and they can send to Congress someone with the political point of view that they have. And so since we have some states that have been taken over by what I would say is kind of a radical fringe of people who don't have the same values that most Americans do, I think we need a lot more vigilance even with our state politics. But it all begins in your community and then getting involved in the state, and that's how we can begin to have better congressional policy.
So and Food and Water Watch does have a place in a location in Fort Lauderdale?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We have 17 state offices around the country.
Well, we just have about 30 seconds left, Winona. Why have you devoted your life to these issues? Is it because you grew up on a farm?
It is, but, you know, I feel like the issues about our food system are reflective of what's happened to our democracy. I want to see a better food system, but I want to see us fight for our democracy so that we can pass on to our children a more vibrant democracy and a better society, not one that's just for sale to the highest bidder.
Well, we want to thank you. Winona Howder is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. That's foodandwaterwatch.org. And she owns an organic farm in Northern Virginia as part of a CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture Project. The name of her book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, and foodopoly.org, the website. Thank you, Winona. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure. Bye-bye.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, Bonnie and I may argue a bit, but that might not be so bad. Psychologist Ilona Jerebek has conducted much research on personal conflict. She says anger itself is not destructive, but rage is. I'm sure I won't win that argument. And calendar time. On this day in 1874, 139 years ago, the birth of modernist composer Charles Ives in Danbury, Connecticut. Probably America's first musician to have international acclaim, his father was a Civil War bandleader. And on this day in 1947, 66 years ago, the House Un-American Activities Committee opens public hearings on alleged communist infiltration of Hollywood. Among those denounced, Katharine Hepburn, Charlie Chaplin, Edward G. Robinson. One more while we reflect on the Camelot era on this day in 1968, 45 years ago, 5 years after President Kennedy's assassination, Jacqueline Kennedy marries Aristotle Onassis on the Isle of Scorpios. So we leave with a thought from Jackie O, recalling the death of JFK, quote, "He didn't even have the satisfaction of being killed for civil rights. It had to be some silly little communist." Our theme music created by Michael Levine. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Here and Now, up next, from Where Else But NPR News.